time. Start thinking about if you've got any cases for consultation. We'll be doing that shortly. But before we get to that, one thing that, you know, for ages, antisocial personality disorder has been considered untreatable. One of the things that's interesting is it's actually one of the personality disorders where we've got a fair amount of outcome data that shows that treatment works. And not just CBT. There are a number of different, you know, residential treatment programs that, you know, have, you know, documented results showing that it produces treatment effects. And they have a variety of different theoretical orientations and rationales and treatment methods. But as I read the program descriptions, one thing they have in common is setting up an environment where thinking ahead, where it's relatively easy to predict the consequences, thinking ahead about the consequences pays off, and where you have to cooperate with others to succeed. And some of these are behavioral token economy programs, where the rules are real clear, the consequences are real clear, they follow through real consistently. Some of them are wilderness experience programs, where if you want to cross the river, you've got to cooperate with other people. You know, if you want to have a campfire tonight, you need to think ahead and chop the wood before it gets dark, etc. And some of the, even the psychodynamically oriented ones, as I read the description, sounds like they've set things up in such a way that thinking ahead about consequences, etc., pays off. And this makes sense. It fits with our model. I think if the therapist is helping you think ahead, you know, productively, that's going to speed things up and produce better results. We've got at least one study providing evidence that short-term CBT is effective with this population. And it's interesting, this was done back in 85, and nobody's heard about it. Why? Because it was published under a boring academic factors affecting treatment outcome with antisocial personality disorder, and it just sort of blended into the woodwork. You know, if it had been, hey guys, CBT works, then it would have gotten noticed better. But Woody McClellan, Laborsky, and O'Brien did a study treated using both CBT and a short-term psychodynamic therapy with antisocial individuals in a VA methadone maintenance program. So we're not talking about a Mickey Mouse light-duty population. For those of you who've worked with VA substance abusers, this is not an easy population. And, you know, what they found was real interesting in that they looked at people with and without antisocial personality disorder and with or without depression. Two different treatments. And they, in addition to self-report measures, they use measures including drug use, maintaining employment, getting in trouble with the law. So we have some hard, you know, objective measures as well as self-report stuff. And both treatments worked. CBT and the short-term psychodynamic therapy worked. But they worked for clients who were depressed at the beginning of treatment, not for the ones who weren't depressed at the beginning of treatment. And on the surface, it seems like, wait a minute, aren't people with two problems going to be harder to treat than people with one problem? But the issue is, for the people with antisocial personality disorder who weren't depressed, what's the motivation for treatment? This was before we thought of using self-interest as a hook. And so, you know, if you're not using self-interest as a hook, if the person's not miserable, they're not motivated. You know, so for both treatments, the people who weren't depressed had no motivation for treatment. It was hard to get anywhere. For the people who were depressed, that provided the initial motivation for treatment. There's a subgroup of people with and there are some other studies also looking at CBT with antisocial personality disorder. The mascot study that I referred to is a good one. They had 52 adult men with a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder and a history of violence in the 6 months before the study, randomly assigned to either treatment or usual or CBT. And after 12, you know, they did a 12-month follow-up, assessing acts of violence, alcohol abuse, etc., as well as self-report measures. And they managed to follow up, do a 12-month follow-up with 79% of their sample. This is not your most stable sample that leaves forwarding addresses and so on, but they did pretty good on follow-up. And they found a decrease in occurrence of verbal and physical aggression, decreases in problematic drinking, improvements in social functioning, etc. You know, so not bad results. Certainly, you know, more treatment wouldn't hurt at all. You know, there's good reason to believe that if these folks persist in treatment long enough, we can accomplish quite a bit of useful stuff. It's not quick and easy to get people engaged in treatment and then keep them engaged in treatment. So that's one of the big issues, and life events can, you know, complicate things. One thing that's important to keep in mind with working with these folks is, just as we hear things from their point of view and stuff makes sense and so on, it's easy to, you know, like these people and start having more benevolent views of them and so on. And it's important to have enough quality control on our own thinking to be aware of the you know, level of bullshit, the possibility that they're trying to mislead us, you know, the risk of violence, etc. You know, looking, you know, in being empathic and collaborating is good stuff, but we also need to keep, maintain perspective. And certainly Davidson and Company recommending ongoing supervision or consultation. They find that this is a population where if you don't have somebody to bounce ideas off of, it's easy to end up being less effective than you could be. Questions before we move on?
This Miller guy,
uh-huh.
I mean, the client, what happened?
Well, this is a one-session demo video looking at generating motivation for change. So at the end of this, he's sounding pretty motivated. The you know, ratio of BS to, you know, legit information has improved substantially. And they basically hashed out a plan of putting his energy into, you know, focusing on the reasons he would benefit from. You know, he eventually ends up arguing in favor of abstinence from alcohol. He ends up arguing in favor of quitting smoking, you know, because, you know, the, you know, and one of the most, you know, in addition to wanting to have, you know, better endurance while playing soccer, which was a pretty good source of motivation for him, the waking up clear-headed and feeling good. And when he smoked a bunch, he didn't wake up that way. When he drank a bunch, he didn't wake up that way. Was a real good source of motivation for change. Now, in real life, we would count on one session generating motivation to result in long-term success. You know, we would figure there's a real good chance that he's going to need ongoing, you know, help with the process. And I'm pretty sure that what they did is after this demo session, then they got him connected with somebody he could work with long-term. Certainly, ethically, it seems like that's the way one should handle it.
That's what I was wondering.
Okay, now we've got an opportunity for some consultation. Who has cases they'd like input on? It's completely optional whether it has anything to do with the antisocial personality disorder or not. So we've got one. Who else?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Is it a question related to antisocial or a different question?
No. It's
okay. Great.
It's anxiety.
Yeah. Okay, great. What we'll do is do your case and then get to your question.
Okay. So. Okay, 63-year-old woman, Afro-American, daughter is dying from cancer, observing her daughter dying. I'm very angry, agitated, feel like she can't control the situation. Came to therapy, literally verbally attacked me. And trying to get her to understand or encourage her to understand how to live her life regardless, because she said her daughter is very positive, even though she knows she's dying, she's very positive, upbeat, outgoing, but she can't be that way because she's angry that she knows her daughter only has several weeks to live.
Yeah. What are her goals for therapy?
Her goals was, which was very interesting, her goals were to, one, she told me she wanted to learn how not to be so controlling.
Mm-hmm.
Another goal was her anxiety is through the roof, so she wanted to reduce her anxiety and try to accept what took place, what is taking place in her life.
Yeah. What questions do people have? What would you like to know?
I missed the goal. What's the goal again?
One goal is to accept responsibility, so control. Try to accept what's going on in her life. Her daughter's dying. And I can't remember what the third was.
Reduce her anxiety.
Anxiety. Reduce her anxiety.
And how did she come to you in the first place?
She was referred.
You know, among those three goals, does she have a preference about what to get to first?
No.
And you said initially she was sort of antagonistic toward you?
Oh my God, yes.
What was going on?
Well, let me tell y'all something real, real fast. Real quick. Afro-Americans do not like to come to Afro-Americans. Okay, so.
Really?
No. Yeah.
We're fine.
No. We'll talk about that later.
Another topic.
You don't think it was a female-female thing?
That She comes straight out and told me.
Mm-hmm.
Really? So she said my population is white, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But was she also resistant to just to the whole premise of being there? And maybe, I mean, she told you goals and objectives, right? So she must be interested in actually.
Well, I came highly recommended, and I was referred to her from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So she has been to other therapists, and she did not like them because she could not control them.
Mm-hmm.
And she let me know that at the door, I run my session away, but I run my
session. Oh, my goodness. And so we've got a couple added levels to it. One is, you know, sounds like this was a way of testing out whether she could control you or not. You know, another is, you know, one hypothesis I always consider based on the way the client comes in is this is telling me something about how they approach life in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly.
We had that night, you know, that 13-year-old kid who comes in to prove that I can't make her do anything she doesn't damn well want to do. Well, that's how she approaches everything. I don't have an upfront guarantee. You know, some clients approach me very differently than they approach people in the real world. But a lot of the clients approach me exactly the same way as they approach everybody else. And, you know, if you think of the experience of black women in this world, just last night we went to see the musical at Kane Park in Cleveland Heights, Memphis, which is about when race music, the black R&B, was first being heard on white radio. And all the issues going on there. And, you know, it reminded me of growing up in the Deep South. And, you know, we got lots of history in this country and lots of issues. And where I grew up, the Klan would have reacted a lot more vigorously than they did in the play. And so we got all that history there. And, you know, historically, black women have not had a lot of control and self-determination. Fortunately, the world is changing some, but not fast enough. And so there's a lot of history that has an impact on what we as individuals do in our corner of the world. You know, and it varies a lot from individual and individual how much of this carries over. You know, one of the things I notice in my neighborhood is periodically I'll pull up to the stop sign, somebody else got to the corner first, they've got right away. Sometimes they'll wave me past. You know, most of the time the person who does that is an older black person, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if they grew up down south where taking right away ahead of a white person was dangerous. You know, I'm old enough, so I was in high school when integration happened. You know, I grew up with kids who on Friday night would go egg the black neighborhood. You know, the Klan was still active in South Louisiana in those days. And, you know, this isn't all ancient history. You know, I played racquetball with a guy who grew up 45 minutes from where I grew up, but he was a black guy, you know, a former Cleveland cop. And there's no way we would have played racquetball together when I was a kid. And so, A, you know, and also we got all the police shootings and crap happening. You know, that part of this, you know, is some people's firsthand experience. Part of it is what they learned from, you know, their folks growing up. And part of it is we just sort of get by osmosis. If I'm out driving with Dad and he lets the white driver go before him, without even thinking about it, I can pick up the sense that that's what one should do. And so, you know, we got multiple layers, you know, that come up, you know, in different situations. Sometimes I can figure that out, sometimes I can't. And sometimes I'm getting an idiosyncratic reaction from somebody that has nothing to do with history and culture and so on. So, you know, this stuff gets real complex real fast. Now, in terms of being helpful to her, you know, one part of it is sorting out, okay, she wants to be less anxious, she wants to be less controlling, she wants to accept what's going on in her life. You know, we're going to want to figure out which of those do we get to first.
If I decide to schedule her back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm serious.
I know you are.
I need good money. If I decide to schedule her back, I think I'm going to approach the control. I think one of her biggest issues is, and it reduced anxiety, is how she is approaching different individuals, because I'm an individual that your body language speaks louder than your words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the way she came in, if she don't want people to treat her any kind of way, you're going to get anxious walking in the door, and anxiety going to go through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So if she is able to control her own inner thoughts about what mm-hmm. she think about herself and try
yeah.
to reflect it on other people,
mm-hmm.
we can work with the anxiety, and I'm going to intertwine that together. So
mm-hmm.
control and anxiety, that's my goal if I take her back. I'm going to work with those hand in hand
mm-hmm.
and let her see why she having so many issues, and then I'll eventually deal with her daughter passing away.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very angry about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to try to intertwine that towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing is that control
yeah.
and her anxiety.
And now there's some complexities in how we do that, because if I'm working with somebody with control issues,
yeah.
and I decide what we're going to work on, that's likely to set off
their control
issues, and we're off and running. You know, if I can maneuver to do it collaboratively,
there you go.
You know,
yeah.
then we're sharing control. They don't have to fight me. I don't have to fight them. Now, also, you know, if I want to work effectively with somebody, I need to, you know, set limits when necessary. You know, if, you know, we're going to waste an enormous amount of time if we spend the sessions with her fighting with me.
Right.
You know. But I need to figure out how to set limits in a way that it doesn't feel to her like I'm controlling her. Now, and again, if we can, you know, if somebody where I might use more than the usual amount of guided discovery and emphasize collaboration a bit more so that it registers that she's choosing to go along with me. It's not me making her do stuff.
Now, what I probably do too, I usually use a notebook, and I tell my clients, I give them a notebook. They don't even have to buy it, but I give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually tell them to write down what they want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel like they're in control.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't be just my session. It's
yeah.
their session. So when they write, when they're able to write it down, what I do, I'm like, are you focused on what you said? And mm-hmm. I can refer them perfect. Back to uh-huh. what they said they want to discuss. So that eliminates some of the, I try to, when it's my control clients, I try to eliminate it mm-hmm. that way as opposed to addressing it in their face and being confrontational. Mm-hmm.
And how you word things can make a big difference. Homework's a great example. A, if I use the word homework, that has a much a very different impact than if I use, you know, self-help assignment. But just the word assignment still makes it sound like it's something they're being told to do. I usually don't use a label for it. I think usually do something along the, okay, so here's what we talked about today. Does this give you any ideas about what would be useful to do between now and next time? And, hey, would that be worth writing down in the notebook? You know, any ideas how you're going to remember, you know, what your game plan is? And, you know, the more it feels like, you know, this is something she's choosing to do because it makes sense to her, the fewer power struggles we're going to have around the homework, the better idea of getting it done. And it gives us some more time to work on the control issues. You know, another thing I would keep my eyes open for a good opportunity. I mean, it sounds like she came into the office anticipating something and was, you know, reacting before you'd said or done anything, basically.
She was,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, with the anxiety in here, you know, one of the things I know is when people are anxious, this increases their tendency to be vigilant for whatever they're afraid of. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, which also sets them up for false alarms and complicates things. And so, you know, an opportunity to, you know, particularly if there's another time when she comes in on edge already, you know, if we can talk, gee, it sounds to me like you came in here today anticipating something. Think back to, you know, on your way here, did you have an image of what was likely to happen? You know, and if we can get that on the table and think of explicit, A, this is useful information for me. B, it gives me a shot of helping her notice how, you know, the anticipations have an impact and sometimes work as self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, if somebody comes in on edge and launches into me, this is going to trigger a reaction for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's going to make a big difference in how things unfold. You know, with the anger about her daughter's cancer, hey, this gives a wonderful chance to be empathic and validate feelings and so on. That doesn't poof make them go away. But that, again, that steps out of the, you know, control struggle. And then, seems like one thing that I find useful with a lot of clients is helping them think through, you know, when things aren't the way I want them to be, when I object vigorously to the way things are, how do I currently deal with that? You know, a lot of people's baseline reaction is, if things aren't the way they should be, the thing to do is to get angry about it. And that's supposed to make a change. And, from what we know so far, it sounds like that may well fit for her. You know, I don't want to presume that, but it gives me an idea of what to scout for, and we could check that out and see. And, you know, if you can, how would I pick up this gut feeling that if things aren't the way they're supposed to be, the thing to do is to get upset about it? Well, hey, when I was a kid, if things weren't the way they were supposed to be, how did the parents and teachers react? Gee, the schools I went to, you didn't bring your homework in on time. Teachers got upset about it. You got out of your seat when you weren't supposed to. Teachers got upset about it. You know, in lots of families, you didn't take out the trash when you were supposed to. Parents got upset about it. And implicit is the message that if things aren't the way they're supposed to be, the thing to do is to get upset about it. And that's supposed to fix it. And if I'm somebody who likes to have control, then getting upset about it, you know, seems like it gives me control. So we got an added incentive there. And if you think about it, there are lots of situations where this strategy pays off. You know, if I order a burger for lunch and they bring me a chef's salad, if I get upset about it, they'll take the salad away and bring me my burger. And so all the times when I get upset about the way things are and it works, encourages me to keep it up. If I get upset about things and it doesn't work, then it's easy for it to feel like I didn't try hard enough. I need to get more upset. And it's, we'll talk about this more when we get to dealing with anger. But it's easy to just persist trying harder and harder with a given strategy without registering, this is not working, I need to try a different approach. And the idea of accepting that things are the way they are makes sense intellectually, but it's often hard for people to get by emotionally. Because, A, if I just accept that whether I like it or not, my daughter's dying of cancer, how does that feel on the control front? That feels like I've got no control. And also, if I accept that things are the way they are, most people's gut reaction is that it won't change. And if it was true that accepting that things are the way they are meant making them permanent, that's a damn good reason not to do it. And so, again, using guided discovery, we can help the client think through, hey, okay, suppose I accept that my daughter's dying of cancer, and the gut reaction is then it won't change. Wait a minute, does that mean if I put my time and energy into being upset about it, it will change? No, the unfortunate reality is whether she's upset or not, her daughter's dying of cancer. Yeah. It would be wonderful if being angry drove cancer away. I would sign up for that if it worked. Yeah. The bad news is, you know, whether I'm angry or not doesn't make the cancer go away. If I accept it, that doesn't make it any more or less permanent. And actually, in a lot of situations, if I refuse to accept that things are the way they are, it gets in the way of dealing with them effectively. And if I accept that whether I like it or not, things are the way they are, it often frees me up to deal with the situation more effectively. The example I use is I happen to have lousy eyesight. Suppose I refuse to accept having lousy eyesight. Suppose I'm really angry about having lousy eyesight. Is that going to improve my vision any? No, it don't work that way. It's a shame it don't work that way. No. Suppose I accept that I've got lousy eyesight. Does that make my vision any better or worse? No. On the other hand, if I accept that I've got lousy eyesight, there are things I can do. I can put on my glasses every morning and see just fine. I could go get contacts. I could sign up for laser surgery. If I accept that things are the way they are, that frees me up to deal with the situation as best I can. And, you know, if you know people who've gotten to the age where they start to need reading glasses, hey, our partner spent a good year and a half refusing to accept that he needed reading glasses before he broke down and got some. It comes up a lot with hearing. Mm-hmm. Most people know somebody whose hearing is shot, and if right. they would only wear the damn hearing aid, everybody involved would come out way ahead. Barb's mom went a good 20 years refusing to accept that her hearing is shot. She was head nurse at a community hospital and had to con other nurses into doing blood pressures for her because she couldn't hear through a stethoscope. Yeah. When she finally broke down and wore hearing aids, everybody came out way ahead. But it's real easy for people to get into a stance of fundamental non-acceptance because it feels like if I accept, it's giving up control, it's making it permanent, and helping them think it through and register that no. You know, A, refusing to accept it doesn't give me any control that I don't already have. Accepting it doesn't mean giving up any control that I've got. Often, it frees me up to exercise what control I've got. You know, in Western culture, we tend to think in terms of control, in terms of controlling what happens. You know, I flip the light switch, the light goes on. I flip the light switch, the light goes off. I've got control over the light. And there are plenty of situations in which control that works that way. If we want to be technical, that's referred to as primary control. There's also plenty of areas of life that don't work that way. Hey, looks like we're having a beautiful day today. The forecast said it was going to rain. You know, it's going to either rain this afternoon or not rain this afternoon. I don't have control over that. You don't have control over that. Does that mean we're helpless? Does that mean we've got no control? Well, we don't have control over whether it rains, but we could control over how we deal with it. You know, if I've got something planned for this afternoon, I could cancel my plans if it rains. I could go ahead and get wet. I could take an umbrella. You know, I've got choices about how to deal with the situation. And choosing how to deal with the situation is just as legitimate a form of control as controlling what happens. You know, if I've got an employee who does stuff I object to, I could try to control them. I could try to make them do what I want them to do. Perfectly fine option. Maybe I'll succeed, maybe I won't. Or I could choose how to deal with this situation, which is another completely legit option.
No, I was just wondering. I said I had a question. Actually, I have a competition question.
Yeah.
Whenever you're ready. Ready?
Okay. Now, let's... I'm just trying to think if I had any other thoughts I wanted to be... Now, another thing that's useful to help the client look at is, suppose I do accept this situation. Suppose I do accept that my daughter's dying of cancer and I'm less angry about it. Okay, that sounds like an advantage to accepting it. What's the downside? What are the drawbacks? Well, it seems to me, if I accept that my daughter's dying of cancer, I'm going to be real sad in the short run. And, you know, one of the possibilities is it's not unusual for people to use one feeling to avoid another one. If I get angry enough, I'm angry, not sad. You know, I'm going to want to at least pay attention to the possibility that, among other things, she may be using anger as a way to avoid sadness, anger as a way to feel in control. You know, if I'm angry enough, I feel in control whether or not I actually have any control. And so, you know, one of the things we may need to talk through is, yeah, there sounds like there'd be a lot of advantages to accepting things as they are. But it means, in the short run, I'm going to need to put up with feeling sad, feeling helpless, feeling vulnerable, and highlighting that if I can accept those feelings and tolerate them, this does not mean being sad forever. This does not mean actually having any less control. This does not mean actually being any more vulnerable. That, you know, one of the things that screws up people's lives is people often put a lot of time and effort into avoiding something, certain feelings, rather than registering that it's a much better deal to tolerate the feelings and let them run their course. You know, this is something Barb's going to be talking about when in special topics with grieving. You know, one of the big problems with grief is people often put lots of energy into trying to avoid sadness, and that causes problems rather than solving it. It doesn't even result in me being less sad, because, you know, if I can go ahead and cry at the funeral and visit the grave and so on, grieving generally resolves pretty quickly. If I put lots of time and energy into avoiding the feelings, it drags things out. How's all that sound? Any other questions? Yeah.
Just one of the things that I use, it's just a reading if she wants to recommend it, is the book of Loving What Is, mm-hmm. of Byron Katie.
Yeah.
Just like take you there to that acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for people who are religious, you know, there may be some religious issue leaders in their life who can be useful resources. You know, all of the major religions have put a fair amount of time and energy into figuring out how do we deal with, you know, loss, how do we deal with bad stuff happens, you know, etc. And for people who are religious, that can be a real useful resource. Another thing that can be useful is helping to get the person in touch with their own values and taking those into account.
And that's also one of the questions I ask, if it's that acceptance, like is there any religious background?
Mm-hmm.
And if they say yes, then that makes it easier.
Mm-hmm.
But if they say no, then I have to say, okay, yeah. What are your, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And if it happens to be a religious background that I'm familiar with, that gives me a big advantage. You know, I grew up in the Deep South. I went through a religious period. I can actually quote scripture for the best of them. And that's a useful resource when I'm dealing with Christians. You know, I've had quite a few Orthodox Jewish clients over the years. I'm now pretty familiar with Orthodox Judaism, though I can't quote that whole lot. you know, there are also plenty of perfectly fine religions I'm not that familiar with, and I, you know, would either need to get some input from the client, helping them think through how their religion sees this issue, or I might need to, you know, learn a little bit about their religion.
One of the things you brought up in the beginning, she sounded like she was, you said she sounded angry, even at you. One of the things, I don't know if you address, I usually do, I kind of see that as kind of inquiring it. I, that just sounded like you are kind of angry. I'm not sure if I'm getting the wrong impression. Tell me, kind of really addressing it to them directly in a very kind of inquiring about. Did I lead you wrong, or what do you think, kind of thing?
Well, when she first came in, I really didn't say too much anything. I just wanted to hear what she had to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to make things worse than what it was, because her body language, like, she, when she walked in, it was just like, you should be here when I get here. I mean, it was interesting, very, very interesting. So I picked up on it as soon as she walked into my office.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wow, okay, let's see what she has to say. So sometimes that works, sometimes, but not all the time.
One thing that can be important in working productively with somebody is, you know, negotiating appropriate limits. It's easy to presume that people know stuff that's obvious to me. I worked with a client once upon a time who periodically would get upset with me, storm out, and slam the door on her way out. And soundproofing was poor enough, so this was disrupting other people's therapy sessions. This was scaring other clients, etc. And if I want to work productively with her, I need to let her know that this is not okay. It's okay for her to be mad at me. It's okay for her to choose to leave the session earlier than I would otherwise vote for. It's not okay to slam the door, because this interferes with other therapists, this scares other clients. And A, she may not have thought of that. You know, she may be so focused on what's going on between us that it hasn't occurred to her that this has impact on other people. You know, or, you know, she may well be aware of that and not care, but, you know, I need to establish some ground rules. You know, if she can manage to not slam the door anymore, we can keep working together. If she cannot refrain from slamming the door, then we're not going to be able to keep working together. She's got a choice. You know, if we need to work on some stuff to get to the point where she's not slamming the door, if we can do it fast enough so that she's not slamming it, you know, then we can work together. You know, if she can't refrain from slamming the door, hey, we can't work. In fact, actually, that client I ended up firing from therapy because we got to the point where she wasn't slamming the door, and then she got mad at me one day and was splashing water from her water bottle around my office.
Oh,
sorry, folks. Not okay.
Oh, no.
And it was complicated. She'd been in a serious auto accident and had a head injury and had some impulse control problems. It wasn't all her fault. But, you know, I can't, you know, work with her if she's going to disrupt everybody else's therapy. I can't work with her if she's damaging my office. You know, if she has neurological limitations, that means I can't work with her, then I'll refer her to somebody who can handle that, which I did. I forget who. And she called a couple of years later wanting to give therapy another try, and I said, sorry. You know, she'd had a clear, you know, warning, and she did it, you know, she knew she was on thin ice, she went ahead and did it anyway. No, we're not going to give it another try. You know, and, you know, and she worked with somebody else, and I think got a lot out of therapy, and I think one piece of it was learning that, yes, I do need to take this stuff seriously. I can't just throw tantrums and intimidate people and get away with it. Were there other hands?
I think you answered mine.
Okay, great. Well, let's switch gears and get to your question.
I actually mentioned that it's more like consultation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 28-year-old veteran who came to me. He actually joined the Army right out of high school, and got married, fought in the war three times. He was at the war zone, and got married at the age of, I think, 18, and still married with a son, 3.5-year-old. He came to me because he feels that he's kind of been snappy, a little impulsive, and so snapping at his child, his wife. So his goal was being able to control that. Initially, that's what he mm-hmm. said. And another goal was he kind of feel a little distance from his in-laws. He lost his mother when he was 13, and dad got remarried and everything, and kind of not close to that at all. So kind of has a distance relationship with his dad, emotional distance. And now he doesn't feel, wife is very connected with her parents and everything. He does, they're very supportive. He likes them as a person, but he cannot make the connection mm-hmm. with wife's family as well. So that's what he came. But about two sessions or so later, he realized, as we started working with losing, you know, being impulsive, losing, snapping at the child, it came out to be, it was actually not his child. It was really unhappiness in his marriage. So he wanted to work on that. So one, my question, I noticed there is kind of, you know, when you work with a therapist, we all do, you feel a connection mm-hmm. with your client. I noticed with him, there was kind of little something in between. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I addressed that directly. So one of the session, I realized that. So I kind of, I took time for him to feel comfortable. I kind of visited about how his experience losing mom at 13, age 13, joining, you know, the army at 16 or 17 and getting married at 18. So we kind of talked about all that, really focusing on him and in case if he's feeling something. And then still he, I feel this mm-hmm. kind of disconnect. And he kind of wanted me to meet his wife. So we're like, and his wife was interested, so I kind of invited his wife. One session, I do that. And talk to, his wife sounded like, there was a lot of can of worms came out. One of the things is that he had an affair, by the way, right after he came back from war. Very one night stand, he said. It's past and everything, but they didn't work it through. It's kind of, they talked about it and things. Sounded like it's still being a problem. And his wife just caught him being on one of the dating sites where you really hook up, not really. And he never mentioned that.
Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, there is something in there. After I addressed that, I thought it would be different. Still not different.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do I approach that? In yeah. terms of, I didn't see any paranoid mm-hmm. personality.
But good question. In terms of time, let me just talk about it a little bit rather than discussing it. With sort of a relatively abstract issue like lack of connection, difficulty connecting, mm-hmm. it's really easy to get lost in words and concepts. So this is the sort of thing where taking concrete examples one at a time is a great idea. And, you know, one option, it would be the usual approach of, can you think of a time when, you know, feeling not connected is an issue for you? You know, what's the situation? What led up to it? What are the thoughts and feelings? And since he came in talking about difficulty connecting with his in-laws, you know, if with that approach, that might be where we end up starting. And that, you know, and taking specific examples one at a time is a good way to get a snapshot. Now, since he's also complaining about marital dissatisfaction, it would be real natural for me to ask, oh, is this a time when it's difficult connecting? Is part of the issue between you and your wife that it's hard to connect there, too? You know, wouldn't it be surprising at all if that's, you know, an issue there? I don't know, but you know, asking would be a good way to find out, and we could look at specific examples there. But when the client's issues are manifested in my office, that gives us the real advantage, because then we've got the opportunity to observe things directly as they happen. And it, gee, you know, it feels to me like sometimes there's a little difficulty connecting in here. How's that feel to you? You know, oh, you know, if that's if difficulty connecting is happening right now, you know, what do you remember? You know, hey, as you came in today, you're waiting in the waiting room, you know, how do you remember feeling there? What thoughts were running through your head, et cetera? You know, right now, it sounds like I'm feeling like we're not real connected. You're feeling like we're not real connected. You know, how are you feeling right now? You know, what thoughts are running through your head right now? And it has the advantage of immediacy. And also, you know, when a person's complaining, I can't do X, whatever, you know, one of the things I'm going to ask about at some point is, suppose, poof, you could, you know, in this case, connect. What would the downside be? Any drawbacks? You know, I can understand lots of reasons you want to be able to, with, you know. And, you know, I can also think, from what I know of the history, you know, does this give me any clues? What was his relationship with his mom like before she died? You know? And one scenario would be, we've got a kid who's got a nice, close, warm relationship with his mom, and then she dies, and then it really hurts like hell. And suppose I let myself connect with somebody else.
They're going to die.
You know, they certainly could die, mm-hmm. or leave me in some other way, and I won't lean myself up to pain. You know, and one of the possibilities is that, you know, he's guarding against pain by not allowing connection. You know, another of the possibilities, let's suppose, you know, it was not a warm, cuddly relationship with his mom. They weren't that connected. Oh, has this person ever learned how to connect? You know, are there skills they're just, you know, have not mastered here? You know, and, you know, depending on the details of the situation, I may have some other guesses as to what's going on. And now, obviously, rather than presuming I've guessed right, I want to look at the evidence and see if it, you know, which of the possibilities it fits with. Including, I want to be aware that we humans are complex, and it's quite possible for several different things going to be going on at the same time. It's quite possible the person has lousy skills at connecting and is also avoiding connection for fear of being hurt. You know, another thing, he's had 3 tours of duty in the war zone. Are there any indications of PTSD? You know, if they connected just fine before 3 tours of duty in the war, and now it's hard to connect. You know, it could be a side effect of PTSD or something. You know, so, you know, we're going to consider a number of possibilities. You know, now, you know, if we can identify, you know, fears that get in the way of connecting, we can address them cognitively and then over time do some in vivo exposure. But, I had another thought and it's escaping me at the moment. Another thing that can be really useful to do is to pay attention to the times when he, you know, how the feeling of connection fluctuates. You know, notice times when he feels a little more connected, notice times when he feels a little less connected. And look at the situation, look at the feelings, look at the thoughts. And one of the things I'll keep my eyes open for is, when he's feeling more connected, are there any fears that flare up then and get in the way? You know, if there are times when he feels more connected and this is good, it's not scary, he doesn't avoid it, under which conditions does he feel more connected? Can we do more of that intentionally? You know, the idea of, you know, talking about his mom's death and series of experiences in the hopes of feeling more connected in the session, great concept. You know, and that often works. If I can help the person be connect more with me, then we may be able to work out how to transfer that to others. In this case, it didn't work. But it's a real good idea to try.
Yeah. Sometimes a connection has to do with fear of losing the self, fear of enmeshment.
Yeah.
That fear blocks, period, you know.
Yeah.
It might be that relationship might be with his mom before that she passed. Then you add another obstacle, now she passed, you know, beside what you explained.
And the fear of being controlled is one that can come up, a fear of how the other person's going to react, a fear of what they're going to think of me. You know, for a lot of borderline clients, they have a hard time connected because they fear that if somebody really gets to know me as I am, then they're going to reject me or attack me. And so it's, you know, it's different issues for different people. Any other questions? Okay, let's take a 5-minute break and then we'll move on to narcissistic personality disorder.